Hi, everyone. Judge Andrew Napolitano here for Judging Freedom. Today is Tuesday, June 23rd, 2026. Our good friend and world traveler, Scott Ritter, joins us now. Scott, a pleasure, my dear man. It's good to see you. Welcome back to the United States. I am glad you're well, and we're anxious to hear about your trip. I want to start with your general impressions from your time in Russia and the environs, your interactions with Russian leaders, thinkers, elites, and ordinary folks?
Well, the first thing I would say is that if you're getting your impression of Russia from Western mainstream media, from social media, you're getting the wrong impression. I'm familiar with what's been being bandied about in mainstream media and been following social media. It's whatever algorithms use to decide what goes in front of people. It's heavily weighted in favor of a pro-Ukrainian narrative. And the pro-Ukrainian narrative is being carefully crafted by the British and American intelligence services. It's an ongoing psychological warfare operation that's designed to create the impression that Ukraine is not just standing firm, but winning, that Ukraine has turned the corner, that Russia is faltering, that Russian leadership is weak, and that the Russian people are starting to lose faith, and that there's a chance if we just keep on putting the pressure on Russia that they'll break, and there will be a Western victory, and Ukraine will be the democracy everybody wants it to be. It's all false. Yes, there are drone attacks. I was in Moscow and St. Petersburg when both of those cities were attacked, and there's no doubt that drones got through and they struck some targets. The notion that these targets that were struck represented strategic targets of immense value to Russia and that the Russian economy took a heavy hit is absurd in the extreme. The notion that the people of Russia are broken by these ongoing attacks is likewise absurd in the extreme. On the same day that Moscow was attacked, the streets of Moscow were full of people just living their life as they do. I spent a considerable amount of time in the Donbass, in Lugansk, Donetsk, and Zaporozhye. Very different situation then. It's a very serious situation. The Ukrainian drones are a ever-present threat. I myself was attacked twice. It's just part of the new reality of war, but let's not be mistaken. The drone pressure being put on Russia by Ukraine is because that's the only vector of pressure that Ukraine has left. They are losing badly on the battlefield. It's a very bloody war. I will tell you this, that talking with the Russian soldiers, talking with their commanders, the Ukrainians are putting up a hell of a fight. And the drones make life miserable for the Russians. They admit it. They are taking casualties. But they are prevailing. They're inflicting more casualties than they're taking. And they're advancing, making significant advances. And they're very confident that they will secure the Donbass region this summer. And there's no reason to doubt them. What Ukraine is doing is targeting civilian infrastructure, targeting civilians, acts of terrorism that is designed to break the will of the Russians who live in the Donbass, et cetera. I've never seen a more resilient, strong people in my entire life. These are people in the city of Melitopol lost electricity and water. There's no quitting these people. They get up in the morning. They do what they have to do. They move on. They are proud of being Russian. They are very satisfied that Russia is doing that which is necessary to win this war, to ensure that they and the lands they live in will always be part of Russia. The Russian leadership, what I'll say for this is all the people out there pounding the table saying that Russia needs to attack, Russia is a sitting duck, Europe is doing this, and Europe must become. There's a question you have to ask yourself, and if you can't come up with the answer, then you shouldn't ask the question. What next? Then what? Okay, so let's say, for instance, that Russia strikes a Polish airfield that serves as the major conduit of these Western weapons that are assisting the Ukrainians. Then what? What's next? And if you don't know the answer to that, then you shouldn't be asking the question, because right now, what I can tell you is that none of this matters. Russia is winning. Russia is on a trajectory of victory. The Ukrainians are not turning the table. They are not having a meaningful impact on Russia or the Russians, and that the Russian leadership is, they are very pragmatic and very wise. They understand that they're trying to be lured into a trap by the West, that if they take these actions that everybody wants them to take to strike Europe, to escalate, that this is exactly what the Ukrainians and the West want. Because as things stand, Europe is crumbling. Keir Starmer's out. Merz is not long to follow. He's gone. That's the German chancellor. Macron is politically dead. These are the big three in Europe that support Zelensky. Their economies, respective economies, are collapsing. Their societies are dissolving. Why would Russia do anything that could serve as a rallying point to sustain that which is collapsing? Russia's winning against Europe without doing anything. This is all propaganda. Yes, there are things going boom. Yes, there is temporary disadvantages for the Russians, temporary discomfort for the Russians. Right. But the idea that the Russian people have lost faith in their government is absolutely absurd. Of course, there is a certain minority on both the right and the left in Russia who are articulating the need to either stop the war or to accelerate the war. But the vast majority of Russians are satisfied with the job that Vladimir Putin's doing.
What European nations are known to be assisting the Ukrainians in attacking inside Russia, Russian assets and Russian people?
Well, we know for a fact that that England has been called out. The Storm Shadow missiles that were used, at least that's the initial assessment of some people that say they may have been an early batch of a new American air-launched cruise missile, the AGM-188. There's no evidence that that has actually been delivered. In fact, the first prototypes weren't scheduled to be delivered until October of this year. So they'd have to be way ahead of schedule in order to reach the operational capability. Most likely it was Storm Shadow that Keir Starmer signed off on. I want to remind people this is back in September of 2024. Keir Starmer was coming to Joe Biden with a red briefcase with the paperwork to get the United States to sign off on using Storm Shadow in such a fashion, and a phone call from Anatoly Antonov, who was then the ambassador, warning what the consequences would be, prompted the Biden administration to back down. Here we have the British boldly crossing this red line. And as Vladimir Putin has said, they know that this isn't something where the British provide a weapon to Ukraine and then Ukraine acts on it. Russia knows that it was the British who gathered the intelligence. It was the British who enabled the guidance. It was the British that basically did everything but push the button. So Britain is attacking Russia. This is a big problem. But again, the people that say, well, then Putin needs to attack Great Britain. Then he does that. And the next question is, and then what? You see, right. Keir Starmer just collapsed. Britain right now is in political chaos. They may not come out of this political chaos. Four prime ministers in 4 years. The next prime minister may not last 4 months or 4 weeks. Why would Russia want to change this dynamic? The dynamic is in favor of Russia right now. So, yes, the British are attacking. The Germans are attacking. The Germans are getting ready to build new long-range standoff weapons that they will give to Ukraine to carry out the attacks. The British and the Germans are collaborating on the Firepoint 5, the Flamingo. We know the Czechs are involved. We know the Danish are involved. I'm sure if I dug a little bit deeper, I could come up with even more nations that are. The United States is heavily involved. I was hunted down by a drone called the Hornet. The Hornet is built by a company that is funded by Google CEO Eric Schmidt. And I promise Eric Schmidt, if I ever meet you face to face, I'm going to punch you in the face because your Hornet tried to kill me. You tried to kill me. And Judge, you know this. When you commit an act of terrorism, somebody providing meaningful support, like building the drone, to that is culpable in the crime as the terrorist himself. And these drones are being used to target civilians, acts of terrorism. And Eric Schmidt is guilty. The Hornet uses Starlink antennas. That means Elon Musk is guilty of committing acts of terrorism. This is the new reality.
Wow. You recently called, I think I have this right, you know, I followed as much as I could from what you've been writing while you were away. You recently called Europe a rabid dog. What did you mean by that?
Well,
only you could say that.
I had been invited to speak on a panel, a pretty distinguished panel. There was the rector, head of INGIMO, which is the Foreign Policy Institute. It's the best university in Russia for international affairs. It's where their diplomats are trained. So the head of that university was there. Several of his professors were there, and a deputy foreign minister of the Russian Federation was there. And I was told that this was sort of a chance for me to establish my reputation as a very calm, rational thinker, because many Russians were intimidated by my passionate moments. And basically the panel was about, you know, the need for diplomacy. Is there a role of diplomacy in the new world? And I was listening to these diplomats, these academics, these, you know, men of peace, basically excuse away everything that Europe was doing. That the day before this panel, St. Petersburg was attacked by drones on the opening day of the forum. There was an ongoing threat of attacks. The Starbell slaughter of 21, innocent, teenagers was fresh in everybody's mind. And I'm listening to this. And I had prepared a statement, and I was going to call the Europeans nihilists. And I was going to get into a Friedrich Nietzsche-laced discussion of nihilism, part of my effort to be academic. But a British guy on the panel had invoked nihilism first. And I was getting angry and angry. So I said, the hell with it. I'm just going to bring up To Kill a Mockingbird. I said, look, Atticus Finch was an American lawyer. He believed in the rule of law, just like these men do. Believe in the rule of law, and law is important. And we don't have civilized society without the rule of law. But what the hell good does law do you when a rabid dog is running loose in the streets? And in To Kill a Mockingbird, they turn to Atticus Finch to kill the dog, not because of his legal pedigree, but because during World War I, he was the best shot in the unit and killed more Germans than anybody else. And when a rabid dog's running the street, the only solution is to shoot the dog. And I said, Europe is the equivalent of a rabid dog, and eventually it's going to need to be shot. That caused an alarm amongst everybody in the audience. And I thought I would be kicked out of Russia, but apparently when they translated it and was sent up to higher levels, I received an invitation to attend the plenary session, and I got a second row seat, which is a very honorable place. So some people were apparently happy with what I was saying, but that's what I meant. And Europe is behaving irresponsibly. But as I pointed out, my name isn't Vladimir Putin, and I don't have the weight of Russia on my shoulders. I'm a military man, and I see a rabid dog in the street, and I want to shoot the dog. But the question it has to be asked is, then what? After you shoot the dog, then what? Right. And if you're going to attack Europe, then what?
What are the prospects for a conclusion to the special military operation?
Russia is going to win 100%. The question is how that victory will be achieved. Will it be achieved by continuing the special military operation as it's going now? We're very close to seeing the collapse of the Ukrainian. I know there's going to be even the odd, Scott, you've been saying this for years. Yeah, I have. And I've been right for years. It's just that Putin operates on a timetable that Scott Ritter doesn't get to influence. And it's based upon factors that are outside of my scope of control. The final urban belt, defensive belt exists in the Donetsk People's Republic, where Ukraine is, Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, and a third city below that's 60% under the control of the Russian Zay, whose name I forget. These cities are about to fall. They're going to fall this summer. When that happens, the Russians will have liberated the Donetsk People's Republic, and the Ukrainian army will have broken. And, then the war will continue to unravel for Ukraine. If Russia can keep Europe from getting engaged, if Russia can keep the war from expanding into Europe, Russia will just sit by and manage Europe's, eventual demise, collapse. It's happening right now, people. I mean, just look at Great Britain. Just look at Germany. Look at France. you're seeing the collapse of Europe. It doesn't matter what the elites do and that, you know, how they echo out their, their pro-Ukrainian rhetoric. Germany is trillions of dollars in debt and seeking to spend trillions of dollars to build a military, that is going to rely on a defense industry that can't even support the military they have today. So the idea that somehow Europe is going to turn into this powerhouse military force capable of, fighting Russia is absurd, and Russia knows that. Russia has no plans to attack Europe. They don't want to expand this war. They want to win this war, and they are winning this war. And I think you're going to see the Donetsk People's Republic liberated this summer, and you may see Zaporizhia, the oblast there, just south of Donetsk, liberated. And then you're going to have a very, very difficult winter for Ukraine. They may not survive this winter. Their infrastructure is bad. And the Russians are preparing forces that are capable of winter offensive, and they may go ahead and retake all of Kherson over the course of this winter, so that when you roll into next spring, next summer, you're probably looking at the war either ending on terms acceptable to Russia, or Russia advancing on to Odessa and maybe linking up the Transnistria region. Sumy may fall, Kharkov may fall. But the Ukrainians can't sustain this this resistance. They're putting up a hell of a fight. Every Russian I spoke to said that they, the Ukrainians are hard fighters, but the Ukrainians are losing, and they're losing fairly badly.
Before we transition over to Israel and Iran, here's one of the last things that Keir Starmer signed off on while he was still prime minister. Britain tests long-range missiles to help Ukraine bomb Moscow. Experimental systems, each carrying a 250-kilogram warhead, could potentially reach the Russian capital from Kyiv. What can you tell us about this? Well, there's Maverick. It's good to hear him.
Well, Maverick is excited by, I think somebody's mowing the lawn across the street, so sorry about that. This is an ongoing European project, because the Germans are doing the same thing. They're building, the United States is doing the same thing. But, this AGM-188 that I spoke about earlier is an American equivalent of this. Basically, long-range strike weapons that are being built that can be just handed over to the Ukrainians and used without, any other fingerprints on board. The Storm Shadow requires England to load in the data, etc. The Scalp is the French equivalent. It requires French engagement. Taurus, the German missile, required German intervention. The new weapons they're building are designed, basically, you build the weapon, you give it to the Ukrainians, and the Ukrainians get to target it and do everything on their own. So this is what the British are doing. They're trying to create an analog to Storm Shadow, which is the current cruise missile used by the Ukrainians, that could just be handed over to the Ukrainians and be hands-free from that point on. And like I said, we know the Germans are doing the same thing. The United States is doing the same thing. The idea is to give Ukraine the ability to continue these long-range strikes to bring harm to Russia, and basically to break Russia's will to continue the fight.
Switching over to Iran and the Memorandum of Understanding, is Israel turning on its last and best ally?
Turning on the United States?
Yes.
The United States has never been their ally. Israel's never viewed the United States as an ally. Israel has been the number one espionage target of Israel, and has been for decades. The Israelis view the United States as the way that a parasite views a host. You need to keep the host alive. You need to keep the host strong as long as necessary while you suck the life out of the host. But that's all Israel has been doing to the United States. And until the American people recognize that, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. Hopefully people are seeing it now, where Israel has no desire for peace. Israel simply wants to, pursue conflict against Hezbollah, against Iran. It's not in the United States' interest to do so. And unless you're one of those people that are willing to subordinate American national security interests to the state of Israel, you have to understand how insulting it is for Israel to insist that the United States continue to back them in these wars that they cannot win without the United States. That's the other thing, too. I mean, if Israel had the ability to defeat Hezbollah on its own, then do it. Do it. But they can't. They need us, because they're getting their butts kicked right now. They're literally getting slaughtered by Hezbollah. I thought Hezbollah was beat, everybody said. No, they weren't beat. And Israel can't beat the Iranians. The Iranians proved that point. But this is the culmination of a decision chain that Benjamin Netanyahu's been involved in for decades. It's that which brought him to power, the fear of the threat, and that he is the only man capable of, you know, making sure Israel can deal with the threat. And now he's taken it up the escalation chain as far as it can go. And the United States is done, finished. And, you know, I tell people, they say, well, you know, the Zionists control everything. No, they don't. The dollar controls everything. And I ask people to go back to 1992 when Bill Clinton was running for president and he was getting ready to, you know, discuss foreign policy, national security policy with George Herbert Walker Bush, the incumbent president who just won Desert Storm. And James Carville famously put a yellow sticky note up on the war and said, it's the economy, stupid. That's all you need to focus on and you'll win. Because that's the only thing at the end of the day the vast majority of the American people care about. What's in their wallet, what's in their bank account, what the price of gas is, how much food costs. And what Israel is finding out now is that they've got us embarked in a war that is having a detrimental impact on the American economy and therefore on the American economic future, or the economic future of the American people, and that the American people will dump Israel in a heartbeat when it comes to preserving our way of life. And our way of life hinges on, you know, a sound economic foundation that won't exist if the Strait of Hormuz is not kept open for a long period of time.
How decrepit, how backward, how incompetent was American military planning that they didn't take into account that the Iranians might strangle oil at the Strait of Hormuz?
Well, the interesting thing is we go back to Trump's first term. If you remember when the Global Hawk was shot down, the big drone over the Strait of Hormuz, and Trump wanted to retaliate by bombing Iranian air defense systems. And the Pentagon said, look, if you do that, we're going to get into an escalation with the Iranians that will end with them closing the Strait of Hormuz. Trump said, oh, we'll just open it up. And the military at that time said, we can't. We cannot open it up. If the Iranians shut it down, we can't open it up with the forces available. And it would take us months, if not years, to assemble those forces. And by the time we brought them to bear, we'd have to fight through line after line of Iranian missiles. It's a war that we're not certain of the outcome, meaning we can't guarantee you that we're going to win this thing. So Trump pulled back, and he claimed that he had mercy in his eyes and want to kill the Iranians. But the bottom line is he pulled back because he knew that we're going to get involved in a cycle of escalation that we could not manage successfully. Now, if he knew that then, why did he think that what changed in his mind? This is the inanity. The difference is Pete Hegseth. Back then, you had a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Lloyd Austin, and you had, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I think Mark Milley, who, were honest and said, we can't do this. We can't guarantee the outcome. Now he has cheerleaders, Raising Cain, the chairman of the Joint, was picked because he's a cheerleader. Pete Hegseth was picked because he's a cheerleader. And these are guys who basically are going to say yes to any military misadventure that Donald Trump wants to engage in because it's tough. We're tough. We can do this. We can rock. We got it. Well, we don't have it. We got our butts kicked because we miscalculated, because we didn't factor in reality. We didn't realize what we realized a few years ago, that if we engage with Iran, this thing's going to escalate beyond our ability to contain it. We will run out of precision strike weapons. This is something that was known back then.
Were you able to ascertain any collective Russian view of the Memorandum of Understanding?
The United States is agreement incapable. This is Sergei Lavrov's go-to phrase, and it deals with the Memorandum of Understanding. The Russians have no faith in the United States' ability to execute this. Almost everything in the Memorandum of Understanding, all the big, hard issues were put off for 60 days of discussion. That means that, we haven't resolved anything, and everything's supposed, in order for all the good things to happen that the Memorandum of Understanding promises, we have to overcome these various hurdles. Iran's nuclear program, the Iranians say they have a right to enrich. The United States says, no, they don't. They say that, the United States will take control of the, of the, you know, 60% enriched uranium. Trump calls it nuclear dust. And Iran said, no, you won't. I mean, these things will not be resolved because Iran didn't lose this war. Therefore, the United States doesn't get to dictate the terms of surrender to Iran. You know, the reparations, the lifting of sanctions, the return of seized assets. These are all things that, you know, if Donald Trump goes through with, it's going to be a huge political issue for him. But ultimately, the big one, the one that stands out, is that the United States promised that it wouldn't threaten force against Iran during the period of negotiations, that the negotiations would be done in good faith. And yet immediately when Iran called out Israel for failing to adhere, Donald Trump turns around and says, I'll bomb you into the dirt. I'll destroy you. It's just like, the Iranians are like,
he threatened the negotiators. He said, you might even not get back to your blanking country. Threatened to assassinate negotiators as the Israelis have done. Here's the quotes.
Yeah. So this means that we're in agreement incapable. Donald Trump can't even comply with the agreement he signed because he went to Versailles and signed this document. He put his Jane, his Hancock on the piece of paper. His signature is worth nothing. He is worth nothing. His word is worth nothing. And under him, America's word is worth nothing. We are agreement incapable. And this doesn't just apply to Iran. This applies now to Russia, who now is looking at Donald Trump saying, we can't believe a word this man says. And the Chinese are saying the same thing. Donald Trump is a liar, a natural born liar. He is a bully. He is a braggart. He is a buffoon. He's anything but a chief executive that recognizes that the power of the presidency brings with it a certain obligation of integrity. Integrity he doesn't possess.
Wow. Well, we'll see where this goes. But the Senate just voted to instruct President Trump to bring the troops home. First time that that they did that. Scotty, it's great to hear your voice and your passion. I wish that I could have joined you on part of that trip. Maybe that'll happen in the near future. Thank you very much for your analysis. As always, spot on, top of the line. Welcome back, my dear friend.
Well, thank you very much.